Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Today is the 15th of December, 2014, here across the Dateline in the land of the rising sun. But joining me from the true north, strong and free, my home and native land of Canada, is our old friend Dr. Tim Ball, who has, of course, been a guest on this program a number of times in the past. So I would suggest that you check out our archives of interviews on CorbettReport.com. But while you're doing that, you might as well check out his website directly. He's, of course, at drtimball.com. That's drtimball.com. Which will be linked up in the show notes for this episode, of course, along with a recent documentary in which he is one of the featured experts by director Luke Dillard, The Global Warming War, which is available as a video on demand from Vimeo.com. Of course, that will be linked up in the show notes as well. Dr. Tim Ball, it's been a very long time since we last talked. It's great to have you back on the program. Thanks for joining us again today.
Well, I'm flattered to be invited back. That's a real compliment.
Well,
and by the way, James, yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say, of course, you're invited back. You have a standing invitation on this program, so don't be shy about it.
No, well, thank you. And by the way, I didn't choose the title for Luke Dillard's documentary, and I'm glad that I didn't. I agree with it. The Global Warming War, and the reason I like the idea of war is because, as the Greek philosopher Aeschylus said, that the truth is the first casualty of a war. And, of course, that's what you and I have been talking about, and what we'll talk about today is what is the real truth with regard to climate change, and how has that truth been distorted? And so, and of course, that's now playing out in Lima, Peru. And what's interesting there is it's a lot of people don't understand how they set up the whole climate change investigation through the United Nations with deliberate strategies. What went on in Peru is what's called a COP, or COP, and that's an acronym for Conference of the Parties. And it's the political group that determine where the world governments are going to go with regard to their actions on climate change. And, of course, that is very critical, and it's the way that they set it up politically is that they always have these, they have them every year, but they always occur after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is the science group that produced the science that the COP operates on. Now, we talked about it back in 2009 and early 2010, COP15, which was held in Copenhagen, and it was a very pivotal one because the Kyoto Protocol, which was the underlying objective of this whole political agenda of using climate change for a political agenda, they were about to introduce a global carbon tax that is a fine against developed countries and the money transferred to the underdeveloped countries or developing countries, and that was going to be handled through the International Monetary Fund. So it would have been a very pivotal point, because you can have all sorts of ideas and philosophies and political agendas, but and step aside for a minute, but one of my favorite cartoons of all time was in the New Yorker several years ago, and it's Moses on the mount with the tablets of the Ten Commandments, and the caption reads, "Great idea, who's going to fund it?" And of course that's why what went on at Copenhagen was so important, because this was the stage at which they were going to fund on a global scale a carbon tax. And that's why the person leaked the emails from the Climatic Research Unit in East Anglia. Now, the Climatic Research Unit wasn't the IPCC in terms of its form and structure, but the people at the CRU control the IPCC. They were pivotal to it. And the person that was responsible for that was the former director of the CRU, Tom Wigley. And it was Wigley and his graduate students in the form of Phil Jones and Ben Santer. And then, of course, they brought other people on board like BRIFA, at the CRU. So they effectively controlled the IPCC, and they particularly controlled critical chapters in the IPCC reports, particularly the data, the temperature data, which of course Phil Jones was in charge of, and then the paleoclimate, that is the past temperature reconstructions, and that was Michael Mann, and of course his infamous hockey stick, and then the computer models, of course, with BRIFA, and then there was another person that was not part of CRU but connected, and that was Andrew Weaver. And what's interesting is how many of these people were also editors of the Journal of Climatology, variously Michael Mann and Weaver and so on. And of course, it was through that journal that they published a lot of the stuff that was then became included in the IPCC reports. So all of this was orchestrated. And as I said, the reports from the IPCC were released prior to the Conference of the Parties. But they didn't release the science report. The science report, of course, is their way of saying, oh, well, we're looking at the science and we know the limitations, but they know nobody's going to read that.
Exactly.
So what they do is they do the science reports, and then they do the impact study reports, which of course are based on the science report, so it's self-serving. And then they then release the summary for policymakers, which is a completely different report and hides all of the failures that the science report identifies.
That's such an important point, and I want to reflect on that for a moment, because in fact that was one of the things that I first noticed when I was first starting to question the perceived and received reality about the climate was back, I believe, in 2007, when they had just released a major new report, the IPCC, and it was all over the headlines. And when I actually went to try to find the report itself, lo and behold, no, the scientific report wasn't going to be released for several months. It was all this hype about this summary, which included data that was not transparent, that wasn't available to the public. So I was at that point beginning to wonder, well, if they're drawing a curtain around it, there must be something they don't want us to see. And that's when I started to take some of these skeptics, quote unquote, seriously. But just to bring the context in for people who might be lost by some of this, of course, we're referring to the original ClimateGate scandal from 2009, which the presumed so-called debunkers will try to tell you has been debunked. But I've done several reports on this, talking about the serious structural problems that were revealed through those emails, and thankfully did go some way towards derailing that agenda that, as you say, was taking shape at COP15. But as you've pointed out before, it's really, ultimately, it's the underlying premise of the IPCC itself, the fact that they take for granted that humans are causing this climate change, and now they're just trying to basically, you know, work out the mechanism of that. And go ahead.
Yeah. Well, one thing that everything you read about Murray Strong, and I not only read about him, I've talked with people that worked with him, for him, and so on. But one of the things that you have to concede to some of these people is that they are very clever in certain areas. And of course, one of the things that Murray Strong is particularly good at is organization. So he knows how to use bureaucracies and set up organizations. And the organization of the United Nations Environment Program, which of course he orchestrated and was in 1992 in Rio, there were two separate parts to that. One of them was, of course, the United Nations Environment Program, which was Agenda 21. And that was the larger idea of humans are destroying the planet and we've got to stop that. And then we've got to control people by world governments, and that was critical to this, by the way, and we're going to see this in the future, James, that they had to have an issue that crossed national boundaries. They had to have an issue that they could say, well, look, there's no one national government that can deal with this. We need a world government to deal with it. And so Strong understood that very well. So at the Rio conference, you had the UNEP program and the Agenda 21, which set up the political side of it. But then he also needed the science data that they could then use and say, well, look, this science is showing that we have to do this, that the world is facing catastrophe and we've got to deal with it, and they needed the scientific evidence. So they, through the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, they defined climate change for the IPCC. In other words, they set up a definition that predetermined the results. Now, I don't know if we've talked about this before, James, but I think it's worth repeating here, because one of the things that, and people now, you know, the level of trust of politicians is so low, and it doesn't matter whether you're left or right or whatever, all politicians are playing games all of the time. One of the things that, one of the games that I learned about was that there was conflict over something, and it was politically dangerous for the politicians to take sides on it. So what or appear to take sides. So what they would do is they say, well, we'll have a commission of inquiry. And one of the things you hear is opposition group calling for a commission of inquiry. But they know that these things are fixed as well. So it's all part of the game that these politicians play on both sides of the issue. And the first commission of inquiry I was appointed to exposed how it's done and what's going on. And it happened to be over conflict over a lake in Manitoba, Canada. And, of course, water, we've talked about this briefly, but we need to look at it more in the future. Water is going to be the next major global issue that they're going to be attacking and looking at for control. There was conflict over this lake. People were fighting on each side, and the government finally, the politicians finally said, okay, we'll have a commission of inquiry. I was appointed to that commission of inquiry, and after a few months, we got the terms of reference for the inquiry. And they were so narrow, they were so restrictive, that there was only one possible conclusion that could be reached. And so I went to the chairman of the commission, who was Doug Duncan, and said to him, look, Mr. Duncan, you go tell the minister that unless we get carte blanche, complete access to all data and all information, I'm going to go to the media and say, look, the minister is trying to predetermine the outcome of this. Well, Mr. Duncan, bless his heart, he's passed on now, but he went to the minister and said, look, Mr. Mackling, you either provide complete carte blanche or Dr. Ball's going to do this. Well, Mackling realized that was a bigger political threat than predetermining the outcome of this inquiry. And so we got all of the information and discovered that there had been four previous commissions, all of which had looked at the problem, and some of them over 100 years old, by the way. But, of course, nothing done on any of them. They were simply a way for the politicians at the time to take the heat off the issue and not have to make a political decision themselves, for which they would be accountable. And so every single commission of inquiry that I've ever looked at anywhere in the world, that's just precisely what they do. And this, by the way, James, is where so many of the conspiracy theories arise, because it's the things that they don't look at. And people say, well, why are you not looking at that? It's what you just talked about. You know, you suddenly started looking at, well, why is this report coming out after, or that report coming out before? And it's what they don't tell you that is really the important factors. And so the classic one was, I was watching Justice Warren being interviewed about the Kennedy assassination, and there's no more conspiracy theory discussion going on the internet than that one. And they said to Justice Warren, well, look, why didn't you look at the mafia connection in Dallas with Jack Ruby and so on? And he very calmly and quietly said, it wasn't in my terms of reference. Well, I knew exactly what he was saying, but the vast majority of the public, that wouldn't mean anything to them. It wouldn't. The implications of that were wouldn't have been significant. But what he was telling people was, look, I was told, don't go there.
In effect, it's a type of bureaucratic control that's kind of woven into the DNA of any given bureaucratic structure so that it can only produce one type of result. There will only ever be one answer that can ever be produced by these types of commissions, making them kind of window dressing around an agenda. And of course, then the question is, what is the bedrock underlying agenda? And something that I always go back to that I think ties together a lot of these different threads is a quote from the 1991 publication of the Club of Rome, The First Global Revolution, where they said, "In searching for a common enemy against whom we can unite, we came up with the idea that pollution, the threat of global warming, water shortages, famine, and the like would fit the bill. In their totality and their interactions, these phenomena do constitute a common threat which must be confronted by everyone together. But in designating these dangers as the enemy, we fall into the trap which we have already warned readers about, namely mistaking symptoms for causes. All these dangers are caused by human intervention in natural processes, and it is only through changed attitudes and behavior that they can be overcome. The real enemy, then, is humanity itself," which is quite a remarkable quotation, I think, and one that I think gets towards the real root of what these issues are.
Well, it's the real root in a couple of ways. One, of course, the person that took those ideas as a member of the Club of Rome was Maurice Strong. Or he likes to call himself Maurice Strong. He was a member of the Club of Rome, as were several other important, powerful people. And one of the things that people have to understand about this, you always hear in the couple of the articles that I've written on what's up with that, saying, oh, we'll follow the money. Well, yeah, you could follow the money at the lower levels where people are being paid or their jobs are involved and so on. But at the levels you and I are now talking about, it isn't the money. These are very, very wealthy people. It's all about power. It's all about controlling other people. And of course, that's what megalomania is about. That's what these people that become the so-called great leaders of the world. It's all about power. And then what their motivation is, it's personal, it's some slight when they were young, it's some whatever it is, but they get into power and they put it into action. And so the Club of Rome ideas that you just quoted there were taken by Maurice Strong and became basically Agenda 21. That was the transition. But if we flip back just for a minute to the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the definition of climate change that they were given in their terms of reference was only to look at human causes of climate change. Because, of course, in that quote you just read, humans are to blame for everything that's going wrong. And therefore, there's no point looking at natural variability of climate. You only look at human causes of climate change. But the problem with that is you can't possibly separate out what effect humans may be having unless you know how much climate changes naturally. But that was deliberate. That's what they wanted. They wanted the scientists of the IPCC to identify how human actions were causing climate change and causing destruction. Now, there's another part, by the way, James, that we mustn't lose sight of, because although climate and global warming became the focus, and as we can talk about in a minute, CO2 became the focus, the Club of Rome was actually more about overpopulation. Because it wasn't just that humans were causing all of these damages, it was that there were too many of them. And then the Club of Rome also decided that not only were there too many of them, but those that were to them meant industrialization, those developing nations were an even bigger threat. So that's why you start to understand that the focus at the Kyoto, for example, where they identified 13 Annex I nations, well, those were the 13 developed nations. They were the ones that had created this problem. They were going to be punished and had to pay for their sins bought through a carbon tax. And then they were going to have to pay the nations that they had that they had caused suffering to the developing nations. So the money that they paid was then going to go to pay for these developing nations for the damage that they had suffered, but also to help them cope with climate change. And of course, what I've just described for you is exactly the debate that went on in Lima, Peru. That was what was going on there. Was, well, here you guys have got to pay for your creation of CO2, the from burning of fossil fuels to become developed nations. So you have to pay for your sins, and then we're going to take that money as the overarching one world government. We're going to give that money to the developing nations. And of course, what's ironic about all of this is that since these ideas were built out of that Club of Rome through Agenda 21 and 92, guess what happened? Well, the climate changed. and the climate that they predicted, which was to be much warmer today than it actually is actually cooler than they predicted. And, of course, that made people start to sit up and say, well, hang on a minute. We're now acting on a prediction that is absolutely wrong. And of course,
not that they'll admit that, of course.
The backbone. Sorry?
Not that they'll admit that it's wrong, of course. They still try to say that this is within the statistical variables of their models and all of this.
Well, exactly. But you see, all that does is then make you look even more stupid. You see, because in science, if your predictions are wrong, you come out and say, look, my predictions are wrong. Therefore, I must go back and look at, well, what's wrong with my science? But they didn't do that because their science was political. It wasn't proper science. And so they doubled down. Now, they've tried to deal with it. And one of the things they did was move the goalposts. Well, what do I mean by that? Well, they started out saying, well, it's global warming. CO2 is increasing because of human production or burning of fossil fuels, and as CO2 increases, the temperature will increase. That was the fundamental assumption, but it was wrong because all the records have shown that when the temperature rises before CO2, in other words, CO2 is not driving temperature, but that was built into their thinking, and it was also built into their computer models. I mean, the only place in the world where a temperature increase causes where a CO2 increase causes a temperature increase, the only place in the world where that happens is in the IPCC computer models. In every other record we've got from any time throughout the history of the Earth, the temperature increases before the CO2.
Don't let the facts get in the way of a good argument, Tim. Come on.
Exactly. but that goes back to everything they've done is been political, but they've tried to argue that it's science. So, for example, one of the things that came out very, very early in the history of the IPCC, and in the early days, by the way, there were 6,000 people involved in the IPCC. It's now down to about 2,400 people. But in the early days, it was 6,000. And they came out and said, look, the consensus is. Well, the consensus was them, the IPCC. And, of course, the minute they started talking about consensus, I knew that it was political, because consensus has nothing to do with science. And just as a step aside here, some of the skeptics were trying to say, well, look, we've got to get our own consensus. And so they formed, they organized the Oregon Petition and the Heidelberg Agreement and the Leipzig. There were three big groups of scientists getting together. The Oregon was the biggest one. And there were Nobel Prize people involved in it. There was 35,000 people. And they were all saying, look, the science of the IPCC is completely wrong. Well, I supported that point of view, but I did not sign sign up, because I was saying, look, a consensus is not right on either side of the argument. And just to counter a consensus argument in support of what the IPCC was doing with another consensus doesn't prove anything. What proves that the issue is what Einstein said. Einstein said, look, if I have 100 things that prove my hypothesis or theory correct, that's fine. But if only one shows it's wrong, then it's wrong. And so that's why I didn't participate. Now, what did they do? They doubled down on the consensus argument, and they came out with a study by a Naomi Oreskes, who's actually a historian of science and not a scientist at all. And she did a Google search, and she came out with 957 articles and said, look, all of them, or 97% of them, show that human causing of climate change is a fact. Well, of course, that's what happens. As everybody knows, your Google search is predetermined by the keywords that you use. So that's no different than the
rigged terms of reference
terms
of something.
Reference.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's you predetermine the outcome by what you put into it.
Yes.
Well, Benny Pizer at the Global Warming Policy Foundation Group, he put in slightly different keywords and got a completely different result. And of course, Naomi Oreskes' 97% figure became famous because Al Gore cited it in his movie Inconvenient Truth. Now, once the Oreskes figure of 97% was shown to be a function of how she did the search and not a function of the fact, then they had to, we've got to get another 97% figure out there. So two researchers, I won't call them scientists, by the name of Cook and Lewandowski in Australia, they claimed that they looked at 11,400 and some abstracts, scientific publications or abstracts in journals, and they said, 97% of them say that human-caused global warming is a fact. Well, people like Lord Christopher Monckton went and looked at the 11,000 abstracts, and it turned out that using their own definitions, only 47 of them said definitively that human-caused global warming was proven. So it was actually less than 3% that said it. And then the journal that published Cook and Lewandowski's article withdrew the article. And when they went to try and get the data on how Cook and Lewandowski did their research, suddenly it wasn't available. And then they deposited it at the University of Queensland, who then said, we're not subject to Freedom of Information Act requests. So suddenly that 97% figure blew up completely. But who's out there using the figure? Is the president of the United States saying, 97% of the scientists agree?
Exactly.
And it's absolutely based on completely falsified data.
And again, I mean, as you point out, consensus science isn't science at all, but it is a very effective thing in the minds of a lot of the public who just see this as some sort of war that's taking place in the headlines. 97%,
we
must go along with it.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exactly. Now, what's happened in Lima, Peru, of course, is that they're fighting a rear guard action. And so they have to keep pushing rather than I didn't finish my point, by the way, about moving the goalposts, because the jig was up starting in around 1998, because at that point, up to that point, the CO2 levels had been increasing and the temperature had been increasing. But starting in 1998, things started to shift. And it became very apparent by the year 2000 and 2001, temperature was starting to level off and decline, but the CO2 levels were continuing to increase. Now, of course, this was in complete contradiction to their hypothesis, which said that if CO2 goes up, the temperature will go up. But Mother Nature didn't read their political agenda. And of course, initially, they could say, this is just a short-term thing. It'll get back on track. Well, it didn't get back on track. And then you got people that were involved in the political science, people like Benjamin Santer saying, oh, well, you need at least 15 years of a trend before it becomes of any significance. Well, guess what? We've now gone 19 years and counting where the temperature has not has continued to decline slightly, but the CO2 level has continued to increase. But what did they do very early? They were talking about global warming. And in the leaked emails, one of the significant leaked emails said, look, this selling of global warming is getting to be difficult because there's very cold winters occurring. And people are starting to say, well, hang on a minute. Why is it cold? And so they changed the terminology. And there's an actual an email in which they're saying, look, this global warming is getting to be a hard sell. We better change to call it climate change. And so that's what they did. They stopped talking about global warming and they started talking about climate change. In other words, they simply changed the terminology. They moved the goalposts.
Exactly now, right. And if people want a very specific example of the ways in which scientists can continue to cling to failed hypotheses, I think this is a particularly instructive example. And I'll point people again, as I have in the past on this podcast, to the list of excuses for this pause in global warming that has lasted anywhere between 18 and 26 years, depending how you're statistically breaking it down. And whatsupwiththat.com has a compilation now of 52 different excuses that have been given for why this is occurring. Everything from low solar activity to oceans eating the global warming, Chinese coal use, the Montreal Protocol, cold nights getting colder in the Northern Hemisphere. It goes on and on, but suffice it to say, they are not going to change their hypothesis one bit. They're just going to try to add various ad hoc pieces onto that hypothesis to try to make it look as if, oh, we knew all along this was going to happen.
Well, and of course, they're getting away with it because most of the public, there's several things. One is that the public can't believe that scientists would do this sort of thing. The second thing is most of the public don't understand the science, and therefore, they can easily fool them. But people are starting, it's becoming so ridiculous and so illogical that people are starting to ask questions. So even people that don't understand, when you have a cold winter and they say, oh, well, that's due to global warming, that's so illogical that people say, hey, hang on a minute. What's that lovely old English phrase, I'm not as green as I am cabbage looking. And so it of course is the way that these things become exposed, that if you keep clinging to the lie, you start having to tell bigger and bigger and more illogical lies, eventually enough of the people will start to say, no, hang on a minute, that's wrong. This is the point that we're at now. That's why I wrote the article on What's Up With That, about people starting to question, well, what's the motive here? Why are they doing this? Why are they lying to us about what's happening?
Well, this is the big question. Before we get into that, because I think that really is the point of this, and I think ultimately, as you say, this ultimately isn't even about the science. It's really about the political uses that is being made of this science. But before we get to that specifically, let's just tie up the loose end here with the Lima conference itself and just talk a little bit about this agreement that has supposedly been reached. For example, earlier today, BBC News had an article, UN members agreed deal at Lima climate talks. United Nations members have reached an agreement on how countries should tackle climate change. Delegates have approved a framework for setting national pledges to be submitted to a summit next year. And this goes on to say that the EU Commissioner for Climate Action and Energy, Miguel Arias Canete, said the EU had wanted a more ambitious outcome, but he still believed that we are on a track to agree a global deal at a summit in Paris, France next year, which to me sounds like this agreement is a lot of hype and ballyhoo about nothing. But I'm interested in your take. What specifically has been agreed here, or is this not really significant?
Well, of course, it's almost too cynical to say that it's a bunch of hot air. But anyway, I'm going to preface this, James, with because I like to do it with examples that people can relate to. And what we've got going on here, of course, is a political charade. As a Canadian, you might remember, or you're too young, but in 1967, Canada celebrated its 100th anniversary, and the premiers of the provinces met in Charlottetown, which is where the original Constitution, or the British North America Act, which is Canada's constitution, was signed. And so they went there to do that, the then premiers. And of course, they also said, look, we're going to renew and we're going to set goals for the future and so on. Well, after the big conference, which was held behind closed doors, the premiers came out and they were interviewed, and they all came out and said, oh, yeah, it's wonderful, we're great, we've achieved great goals, and we've set great goals, blah, blah, blah. The premier of Newfoundland, and the Newfoundland people are so known for their bluntness and their honesty, Joey Smallwood came out and said, here's what happened. We met, and we agreed to meet again. And that was the blunt truth of it. But, of course, unfortunately, you don't have enough politicians like the Joey Smallwoods. Now, having said that, of course, nobody was more political than Joey Smallwood. But this is what has been going on at these COP conferences, that they have to come out with something. They have to come out and say, we've got goals, we've set goals, we're setting targets, and so on. But in fact, all you have to know is that what they've agreed in Lima, none of it is binding. Nobody has to meet that goal. And one of the things that's interesting is that the European representative there, representing Europe, of course, represents the member nations of Europe. And one of the problems they've had all along with the protocols and what's been going on is Europe has been making agreements on behalf of the member nations, and five or six of them all along have disagreed with what they're being committed to by being members of Europe. And so when the European representative comes out, and you could see it with Ireland, you could see it with Spain, they said, no, we don't want to meet those targets. But that's exactly what happens, of course, when you become part of a group, you have to go along with the group. Now, what's happened in Lima is that everything's caught up with them. Because, as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, the original 13 nations of Annex I were, and Europe was involved, was included in that, had to reach, come up with setting targets for reduction of CO2, and they had to do that by putting in place carbon taxes, and that money was then to go to pay the developing nations to help them deal with climate change. Now, the irony of it was that when that original agreement was put in place, China and India and Russia were developing nations. And so what's been happening at Lima is those developing nations are saying, hey, we want our money. We want at least $100 billion that you've promised us from the start. And, of course, the developed nations are seeing their economies suffering because of restrictions on fossil fuels and all of these issues going on in the world economy declining. And then you see on top of that, of course, the price of oil plummeting. And suddenly, so the economy, economic situation has completely turned around. And then at the same time, the world is in a cooling trend. So nothing is going as they predicted it to be. And so this is what they were confronted with in Lima was, as I said, climate had changed, the economic conditions had changed, and suddenly now nations that were previously being bullied by the environmental overriding thing, well, we've got to save the planet, and suddenly all of that has lost its potency as well. And it's lost it because of countries like India. And by the way, I happen to think the Indian Prime Minister is one of the best leaders in the world today. But what did they do? The Indian Prime Minister said, look, we're going to set up a commission to look into, well, what are the facts of all of this? Because you're asking us to reduce our fossil fuel use, to cut back on our economic development and so on. And what are the facts you're using? Well, you're telling us that the global temperature might go up half a degree in the next 65 years, and the chances of that are very slim. And so you're expecting us to base all of our economic restrictions on development on that. Well, we've got higher priorities. We've got people starving to death. And so this is what they were confronted with in Lima, was all of the dynamics of what their original arguments were have changed. And so countries were standing up and being prepared to be pointed at and said, oh, well, you know, I mean, it's like Canada. You know, well, you're not meeting your targets. Well, no, but the targets don't make any sense. The science is falling apart. And so countries finally starting to get some backbone against this moral high ground that the environmentalists have taken. And by the way, one of the things that people don't understand is in Lima, there were 10,000 people in attendance, but 5,000 of them were NGOs. They were people representing Greenpeace and the Sierra Club, but there was nobody there representing the ordinary working class people. There was nobody there representing the business community. But that was what Maurice Strong wanted. He brought the idea of an NGO, a non-government organization. He picked it up from the League of Nations over almost 100 years ago and said, here's how we can get a political control by allowing these environmental groups to take the moral high ground. And so, as I said, of the 10,000 people in Lima, 5,000 of them were NGOs, not representing the world at all.
No, and of course, a lot of them with their funding tracing back to the Rockefeller Foundation and other such organizations that obviously have their own part to play in this agenda and are nexused in with the Club of Rome and these other groups that are setting the agenda. I think you're right. If this is a pendulum that is swinging back and forth, I think the momentum towards the alarmism side has definitely decreased in recent years as more countries are eschewing this. And in that regard, I think that this Conference of the Parties charade that's being played out every year is somewhat farcical. The thing that concerns me more is actually bilateral deals and things that go on behind the scenes that don't get as much attention, such as the U.S.-China climate deal that was struck last month. Do you have any thoughts on that deal and what that portends for this pendulum?
Well, of course, that was done deliberately. And Obama, of course, not only losing political power at home and everything else, but he made climate change central to his agenda on an international basis. His one at home was the Obamacare, and of course that's losing popularity. But on a global scale, climate change was his agenda. So he arranged that deal at the ASEAN meeting with China. But if you go and look at it, first of all, the U.S. president cannot sign treaties. All he can do is reach some sort of an agreement of intent. So if you go back and look at the China-U.S. deal, it's a series of intents, but with no commitments whatsoever. And any commitments or any intents that were in it all favor China. China simply played Obama like a fiddle in that deal, and of course America had intents by the year 2020. China's were 2035. I mean, it was just laughable, but it was absolutely essential for them to have that prior to the COP meeting in Lima. And so they were touting that and said, well, look, here are the two biggest nations, the two biggest producers of CO2, China and America, and they're prepared to do something about it. This was all prearranged by the politicians, all smoke and mirrors, to say, well, look, these two big nations, they're the leaders, and therefore that's going to be the foundation of our COP meeting in Lima. And it was a total, total farce. So, as I said, nothing will be done. It's all smoke and mirrors, and the Obama-China deal was part of that. But there's a larger issue going on behind this that is not being talked about, and that is that there is a group of nations called the BRIC nations. The BRIC is an acronym for Brazil, Russia, India, and China, and South Africa. It's BRICS, actually, is the proper pronunciation of it. They represent 48% of the world's population. They represent 106 nations at the UN, which means then, because each nation at the UN has a single vote, so regardless of the size, it has a vote. And so 106 nations can control any vote. And this, by the way, is another thing that went on with the whole climate change issue. Because what did they do? They got nations like the Maldives out in the middle of the Pacific, and they said, "Look, oh, you're going to be underwater, and therefore we need your vote at the UN. We need your vote on the Kyoto thing." And they had one vote, which is equal the population of the Maldives, one vote equal to all of the people in China. I mean, it's so ludicrous.
Yes,
but that's always
yes.
been the problem in
so
the UN.
Just to be clear, right? you say and, the and BRICS countries it, are the yeah. are the nexus of this 106 nation bloc. The not the BRICS nations themselves
yes.
have 106 votes. Yes.
No, but the members of BRICS there are 106 nations.
No, there are five nations.
The BRICS:
Brazil, Russia, India,
are,
China, and South Africa.
Yeah, exactly. Now, some of the things that they've been doing, and notice, by the way, their role in Lima and Russia, India, China, and Brazil are all the developing nations. So in the annex, in the original Kyoto, they're the ones that are supposed to get money from the developed nations. So it's to their advantage. Now, they've already set up a fund equal to the, not equal in dollar value, but equal in importance to helping out other nations by lending the money, and it replaces the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank. And not only that, but they're taking control of global shipping, and of course that is really the control of the world. And one of the ways they're doing it is they are building a second canal through Central America, through Nicaragua. And China is funding most of it, and China is going to be in control of it. And of course, Nicaragua is where they wanted to build the Panama or the canal originally, but for political reasons, it ended up in Panama. And of course, that was the worst place. And where, now China claims that they're going to have this canal operating by 2017. And that's feasible because most of it, most of the length of it is a great big lake. So all of these things are going on behind the scenes, political and economic, and all of them benefit those nations that are the developed nations in the Kyoto Protocol. And so, and by the way, the leader of the European group at Lima, Cristina Aguirre, and she was saying, "Look, $100 billion is nothing. That's not enough money. We've got to give these people $90 trillion." And so the power plays that are going on here in terms of economies, in terms of transfer of wealth, in terms of one world government, it's just unbelievable what's happening. And Lima is just simply a charade, an absolute charade.
Well, it does bring me some degree of comfort to hear that these deals that they're hyping are just hot air. But I think they, as we've outlined here, do represent an agenda that is obviously continuing to be pushed and I think still needs to be taken very seriously because I don't think it's going to go away.
Oh, yeah.
But having said all of that, I think we are running out of time for this particular conversation. So I think we've set the table very well for next conversation, which I'd love to have with you regarding the nexus of geography and history and politics and this environmental agenda, because I think there's a lot to be said about that and where this is ultimately heading. But we are out of time for today. So, Dr. Ball, of course, we will refer people back to your website once again, where they can keep up to date with you and your articles, as well as the Global Warming War, the documentary that we talked about earlier. Are there any other resources you'd like to direct people to with regards to what we've talked about today?
Well, no, I mean, there are some very good websites out there. If they want good CO2 science and climate science, the website CO2 Science, run by Sherwood and Craig Itso, and that has been a brilliant site from the very beginning. And of course, one of the things that we've got to remember is that CO2 is not important in terms of global warming or climate, but it is absolutely essential to life on Earth. And one of the great tragedies of all of that's been going on is that Al Gore saying, well, CO2 levels are the highest in ever, and they're not. They're the lowest in the history of the world. In fact, at 400 parts per million, most plants are malnourished. Plants function better at the 1,200 parts per million, which is the average of level of CO2 on Earth over the last 300 million years, which is the period when plants evolved. So plants have evolved to operating optimally at 1,200 parts per million. And so at 400 parts per million, they're malnourished. And yet these people want to reduce the CO2 level in the atmosphere. And when you get, they're not going to be able to do it because human contribution is so minimal. But when you get down to about 150 parts per million, the plants start to die. And if you get plants dying, then you get no oxygen and there is no life on Earth. And of course, maybe that ironically would be what they want, in that the population, people, humanity is the problem, as the Club of Rome have identified. And so maybe they'll achieve their goal and get rid of all the people on the planet. It's a notion that I'm familiar with, because at the university, a lot of the faculty say if we could just get rid of the students, it'd be a great place to work.
I'm sure that is said from time to time. Well, let's leave it there on that note. And that is an ominous note. And I think it puts this conversation into perspective of why we are so concerned about this issue at this point, and why we still continue to hammer home the truth about this issue. So we will, of course, direct people to CO2 Science as well, and that link will be in the show notes. All right, Dr. Tim Ball, thank you so much for your time. I'm looking forward to our next conversation. Thank you again for joining us today.
Lovely. Thank you, James.